This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. World in progress.
On today's program, religious conflicts deepening ahead of the upcoming Turkish elections.
Kurds want to teach their own religion in Kurdish language. We want a new constitution and a new agreement with the government and the people.
Foreign medical staff stay to help Libyans in Nalud.
But it's not working because this bombing. We are now too much suffering. No, cannot sleeping nicely. We cannot moving, cannot go outside. We are now too much suffering.
And how high food prices are affecting people in Senegal.
Yep.
Rice is expensive, oil is expensive, sugar is expensive. Every time you go to the market, the prices are higher. Enough is enough.
Hello and welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Raspar in Bonn. Turkey will vote for a new parliament on Sunday. While the Islamic-rooted AKP is enjoying a comfortable lead in the polls, in the country's predominantly Kurdish southeast, the AKP is still facing competition from candidates campaigning for greater ethnic rights. For decades, that struggle has been largely secular. But as Dorian Jones reports from the predominantly Kurdish region's largest city of Diyarbakir, religious rights have become the new battleground.
Every Friday in Diyarbakir, Muslim worshippers boycott Friday prayers at the state-controlled mosques to hear sermons in their native Kurdish language. Despite the blistering midday sun, thousands turn out to worship in front of the city wall.
We are Kurds. This is our native language, the language that our parents taught us. Let us speak this language in the courts, in the mosques, on the streets. Until we're no longer forbidden Kurdish in our mosques, we'll do our prayer on the street.
Kurds make up an estimated 20% of Turkey's 70 million or so population. Until the late 1980s, the Kurdish language was banned. Under successive governments, restrictions have slowly been eased in education and broadcasting. But in the mosques, Turkish remains the only official language. In Turkey, the Islamic faith is strictly controlled by a state body called the Diyanet, which oversees the appointment of imams and the writing of sermons. The protest has now spread across the predominantly Kurdish southeast. The leaders of this growing movement are not your typical rebel rousers. They belong to Diyadeh, a group of retired imams and Islamic scholars. Its head is Zaid Çiftkoran. He says they decided on their protest after their appeals for reform were ignored.
This region is a very devout community. We had this demand of the Diyanet, which controls religion in Turkey, to have the sermons in our native language, because according to Islam, you're obliged to listen and understand what is being said. But our demands were ignored. Instead, the government sent 10,000 new imams to this land who have no connection to the area. So it's a kind of religious assimilation, and we won't accept this.
The protests appear to have wrong-footed the pious Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who is fighting for re-election. His Islamic-rooted Justice and Development Party, AKP, likes to pride itself as a defender of religious freedom. But the AKP is engaged in an increasingly bitter battle for votes with the country's Kurdish rights movement. Last week in Diyarbakir, in Erdogan's keynote speech to the region, much of his address was devoted to lambasting the protest.
They refuse to pray behind an imam appointed by the state. But they are not religious. They see Öcalan as a prophet. They're cheating you. Let us teach them a lesson.
Öcalan is the jailed leader of the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK, which has been fighting the Turkish state since 1984. Its Marxist socialist ideology, traditionally hostile to religion, has dominated the region's Kurdish rights movement. But the Prime Minister's attack caused dismay among many Kurds, even among some of his senior Kurdish members, like the deputy head of the AKP in Diyarbakir, Muhammad Akka. He says the mosque boycott is an indication of an important change in the region's politics.
I personally support the protest. I think it is positive as it is a basic right, even though it's not my party's policy. The demand for religious freedom is coming from the growing religious Kurdish movement. This region is traditionally devout, and religious movements are now re-establishing themselves. 4 or 5 years ago, I feared that there would be a clash between secular nationalists and religious Kurds. But instead, for the first time, Kurdish nationalism has come together with religion. There is now a resurgence in Kurdish religious demands, and the state and mosques cannot keep up.
The introduction of candidates at the last major pro-Kurdish BDP rally in the city of Diyarbakir clearly shows the transformation the party's undergone. In the previous 2007 general election, in which it was defeated by the AKP, it had drawn on candidates from its base, many of whom were linked to the PKK. This time, it's cast its net far wider, including liberals and key religious Kurdish figures. BDP supporters are working hard with only a few days left to the polls. 2 out of the 6 candidates are well-known religious figures within Diyarbakir. One of them is Altan Tam. He says along with the traditional key demands for Kurdish education and local autonomy is the demand for Kurdish religious rights.
When Luther published the Bible in German language, until this time nobody can understand the Bible. What is it? Also, Kurds want to teach their own religion in Kurdish language. If they will not solve this problem, we will make Kurdistan as Egypt, like Syria, like Libya, like Yemen. So we don't want this thing. We want a new constitution and a new agreement with the government and the people.
The Prime Minister has committed himself to introducing a new constitution after the June 12th election, but he's given few details about it. The Turkish army is rumoured to be increasingly alarmed over the boycott of mosques and the metamorphosis of the Kurdish movement. In response, the Diyanet has taken tentative steps to allow Kurdish to be used in some mosques, like religious chants like this one, which has been sung by Omer Kılıç. Kılıç sung this at a religious ceremony last week in Diyarbakir's main mosque, the Ulu Cami. For him, it was a very special event.
It was a beautiful evening. Some of the old men were crying as if it were their first time to hear the Mevlid Cantata sung in their language. It's a start. I don't understand why everything can't be in Kurdish. It's not as if it will bring about the apocalypse.
Whoever wins the forthcoming Turkish election will face a rejuvenated and never more united Kurdish movement, demanding fundamental reforms. Dorian Jones, Deutsche Welle Radio, Istanbul.
More than 500,000 foreign workers have fled Libya since the conflict started in February. But not everyone's left the country since the fighting erupted. In Nalut, a town nested on top of Libya's Nafusa Mountains, there's a hospital where, before the conflict, more than 200 doctors, nurses and other medical staff used to work. While most others have fled, about 80 nurses and doctors from Southeast Asia and Eastern Europe have stayed on to care for their patients here. They say they were here before the war started, and they've decided to stay, despite the fact that many locals as well as foreigners have long left town. Marine Olivezi spent 3 days with a dedicated medical staff at Nalut Hospital.
There's been fighting all day on the outskirts of Nalut, and Grad rockets have been raining in town for 2 hours straight when the first casualty of the day arrived in the ER.
Gunshot. That was gunshot in the chest and descending to the abdomen. And it did laceration or wound in the liver.
Crowded around the operation table, nurses from Ukraine and the Philippines, a Pashtun anesthetist from Pakistan, and 2 surgeons, one from Egypt, the other from North Korea. Joma Mitawa says it's a familiar scene at this hospital. He was running the lab back in 2005. He returned to Nalut, his hometown, a few weeks ago when he heard about the staff shortage.
We are few, yes, because all Libyan people not here. All the nurses, Libyan nurses, went to Tunisia. And a lot of people work here went to Tunisia.
Others joined the rebels' ranks, like Naji, the man brought to the ER that day. Naji used to work as a lab technician at the hospital. When the uprising began, he traded his scrubs for khakis. He was with a group of rebels marching towards a village besieged by Gaddafi troops when he got shot. Before the conflict, Libyans and foreigners equally staffed the hospital, the second largest of the region. Now it's mostly run by foreigners. Cecilia Castillo is a lab technician from the Philippines. She says the decision to leave is more difficult for them.
Once you cross the border, we can't come back. And besides, they need us here. Yes. Yes, they need us here.
Cecilia has been working in Nalut for 7 years. She spent 12 years before that in Misurata. She says Libyans are her people too, and she wants to keep helping. Ali Gernaz is the hospital's acting director. He says foreigners stay here out of a keen sense of duty and loyalty.
Can you believe the cleaning? We have one physiotherapist specialist. She cleans the room. She's a doctor. She cleans the room, really. And she likes to help us. Because now there's a shortage in everything in Nalut Hospital.
Nalut was one of the first towns in Gaddafi's western stronghold to liberate itself. That was back in February. Gaddafi's forces have launched rockets into the town almost daily ever since. Usha Barai from Bangladesh is a senior nurse at the hospital. She also wants to stay, but says she doesn't know how long she'll take the shelling.
Brain not working because this bombing. We are now too much suffering. No, cannot sleeping nicely. We cannot moving, cannot go outside. We are now too much suffering.
Ali Gernaz says the remaining staff had to move into the hospital's basement.
Nobody can go home. They sleep there in the hospital. They eat at the hospital. They cannot leave the hospital. Now emergency, all of them in the hospital. Even me.
Around the kitchen table, Usha, the Bangladeshi nurse, and Cecilia, the lab technician from Philippines, are fixing coffee from a dry mix of sugar and Nescafe. Only 1 teaspoon per cup, though. The bottle's coffee grounds have gone down to alarming levels. Chatting with a Pakistani doctor on duty that morning, Usha wonders when life here will get back to normal.
Not in the near future, I don't think so.
Then Usha voices the other issue that's on everyone's mind, money. They haven't been paid since February.
Forget about salary. Who will give you salary? They have to give salary to all Nalut people, to Zintan people, and Misrata. So they are not one or two person whom they have to give salary, and for 3 months. It's a huge amount.
Opposition leaders have arranged to provide food and other essentials to the staff. Lorna Improgo comes out of the weekly handout with 2 bags of rice, tomatoes, cooking oil, and lime cakes.
We are lucky we have food, but we don't have salary. How is that lucky? It's not lucky.
A young lab technician from Nalut passes by. He jokes, what's the use of money anyway? All the shops in Nalut are closed.
No, we work here because our families, not for ourselves. Okay. We know that the hospital will take care of us, but our family, who will take care of them there?
Lorna used to send up to 2/3 of her salary to her son, a college student in the Philippines. He was only 3 when she left for Libya 20 years ago. She wanted him and his sister to go to good schools, private schools. Now he's only 1 semester away from graduation, and scrambling to come up with tuition. The $1,500 Lorna was to wire him over spring would have covered most of it. Lorna says she believes she'll be paid in full at some point, but only if she sticks around and helps the victims of a fight that goes on and on. Marine Olivesi for Deutsche Welle Radio in Nalut, Libya.
Coming up next here on World in Progress, the development news with Hannah Wandel.
Europe must act to save fleeing migrants, writes Chief. Europe must do more to prevent the deaths of hundreds of migrants fleeing Libya in overcrowded boats, the Council of Europe's Commissioner for Human Rights said on Wednesday. More than 1,400 people are likely to have drowned so far this year while attempting to cross the Mediterranean, EU Commissioner Thomas Hammarberg said. He added that European governments and institutions have more responsibility for this crisis than they have demonstrated so far. At least 150 people drowned when their boat capsized off the Tunisian coast last week, the Commissioner said, and about 600 people lost their lives in a similar accident in May. Most victims came from sub-Saharan Africa and had found themselves trapped in Libya. Corruption hinders Congo's development. The World Bank has condemned corruption in the Democratic Republic of Congo, emphasising concern about its ability to foster small businesses. DRC, one of the most mineral-rich countries in Africa, has fallen ill to poor government, corruption and badly targeted taxation, the World Bank said. It emphasised that these faults are hindering the creation of small businesses, which are the lifeblood of employment in most countries. The unemployment rate in the formal sector in the country is currently at about 75%. Poor governance translates itself into abuses by public bodies and officials who collect both formal and informal taxes from the private sector, the World Bank report said. The bank also urged the Congolese people, who are headed to an election in November, to adopt a government with plans to stimulate employment for skilled workers. Yemen facing humanitarian catastrophe. The ongoing fighting in Yemen is threatening a humanitarian crisis, according to development experts. The political uprisings have enhanced the food crisis in the country, with malnutrition worsening. In addition, tens of thousands of people have been uprooted by the unrest. The UN said that the capital Sana'a is low on essentials such as water and fuel. Yemen's UNICEF representative said on Tuesday that a quick end to the current political crisis was crucial, since 40% of the population live below the poverty line, outlining significant future repercussions. Discrimination in China hinders AIDS fight. Recent confessions from an HIV/AIDS sufferer have drawn attention to China's discriminatory attitude toward the disease. Meng Lin, who was infected with HIV, said that discrimination is hindering China's fight against AIDS. "When I was diagnosed, there was no information. It was terrifying. Hospitals wouldn't accept me. They told me there was no room for me," Lin said. He added that he could only get help by changing his name and purchasing antiviral drugs from overseas. China currently admits that at least 740,000 people are living with HIV from a population of 1.3 billion. But due to the stigma, campaigners say many have not come forward, meaning the actual numbers may be much higher. In February, China issued a warning of a grim AIDS situation, stating the disease has become highly prevalent in some demographics, including homosexual men.
And that was Hannah Wandel with the development news. With the highest rate of infant mortality and not enough medical staff, healthcare is still insufficient in many rural regions in Africa. Modern communication technologies can help to improve the miserable situation. Every year, experts meet at the e-Learning Africa conference and discuss how new technologies can be used to boost Africa's development. Last week, this annual conference met for the sixth time, and the delegates came together in Tanzania. DW's Jan Philipp Scholz noticed a lot of participants were using their mobile phones quite often. His report is presented by Sarah Steffen.
What do you think? Press 1, press 3.
Should I press 1?
What do you think? Press 1 or 3? It sounds just like a customer support hotline, but Alex Mando, a young man from central Tanzania, is actually listening to a story on his mobile phone. The story is told in much the same way as a soap opera, but the tale deals with how to wash your hands, the proper toilet usage, and other hygiene issues. Alex, the listener, can then decide how the story proceeds. He can answer questions by punching in numbers on his mobile phone. The service is free, as he doesn't have to pay for the call. This service, named iCall, was invented by the Tanzanian Muhimbili University in cooperation with European AIDS. Dennis Mazzali is the head of the Hygiene Institute of the university and remembers how the idea of an interactive hygiene service has evolved.
When we are discussing with my students how the importance of the toilet and the technology, they were saying, look, Mazzali, in Tanzania, people have more mobile phones than toilets. So that's the fact.
They decided that they wanted to develop a service aimed at people in rural areas. This means no fancy multimedia applications. They would only work on modern smartphones with high-speed internet connection. Simple audio files can be accessed by all mobile phones. That's important for reaching people in rural areas with cheaper phones. Dennis Mazzali again.
95% almost are living in the rural areas. And in rural areas, the health services are not there. And more terribly, that the majority of health workers, they are not interested to go and work in the rural areas.
In a second step, nurses, caregivers and midwives should benefit from the services as well. They should receive news from their professional fields on their phones so that they aren't cut off from medical developments any longer, even if they work in rural places far away. According to Arndt Bubenzer, head of the Austrian consulting company Common Sense, it's the same interactive mobile phone system that has been used for the rural population's health stories.
But not with the story approach anymore, but with factual information on different levels. So it is supposed to deliver new tips, tricks, facts of research and so on, down to that level of community health workers and midwives and nurses.
It's the education system for the rural health workers that caught the interest of the Tanzanian Secretary of Education, Shukuri Kavamba. He openly admits that Tanzania still lacks in training of health professionals in rural areas, but with a little help from modern technologies, such as mobile phones, this shortfall could be met in the future.
The education of medical doctors or the medical profession in general tend to benefit quite a lot because access for information, access for learning material from around the world is highly facilitated by using information and communication technologies.
But for many rural areas in Africa, there's still a long way to go before medical professionals are able to instantly access information and learning materials on their mobile phones. Sarah Steffen, Deutsche Welle Radio.
And for our next report, we stay in Africa to continue our mini-series on human rights around the world. The increase in global food prices is posing serious problems in the West African nation of Senegal. Many families can't afford to buy the food they need to survive, and some people limit themselves to just one meal a day. Human rights activists warn that the gap between haves and have-nots is threatening to grow larger and larger. A report by Babu Diallo and Dirke Kopp, presented by Guy Degen.
Thousands of young people protest on the streets in the centre of Senegal's capital, Dakar. They're protesting against the most recent and a seemingly endless stream of food price hikes. Many women are among the demonstrators, and it's not surprising that there are a lot of women protesting. They're usually the ones who have to find a way to feed their families, whatever the price they have to pay. Tuti Sam is one of them. She's on the street because she's sick of watching food prices go up.
Food is expensive. A sack of rice is expensive. Tomatoes are expensive. Absolutely everything is expensive. I'm doing everything I can just to make sure there's food on the table every day. But everything is just so expensive.
It wasn't long ago that the president of the World Bank, Robert Zoellick, warned that more and more people are being pushed into poverty because of rising food prices, and that further increases would threaten an even larger number of people. A World Bank report noted that food prices had gone up by 36% compared to just 1 year ago. And although the people of Senegal are caught up in a global problem, Alioune Tine, the president of the human rights organisation RADO, says it's up to the Senegalese government to take care of people here.
Le droit à la nourriture, le droit à la santé.
The rights to food, health, education and work are fundamental human rights. And as far as I'm concerned, whoever is the head of state has to make sure the people have enough to eat. But one thing is clear when you look around in Africa, most crises come from the state's ineptitude at dealing with these challenges.
In Senegal, Tine says, there's a serious gap between the elite and the rest of the population. The elite minority is comfortable and wants for nothing. But even the middle class in the suburbs of the capital, Dakar, is faced with dire problems when it comes to getting enough to eat without being driven into poverty. People here can often only afford to eat once a day. Fatou Bintou Diaye is a wife and mother who lives in Dakar and tries to feed her three children and much of her extended family. She also took to the streets to raise her voice against the high price of food.
Rice is expensive, oil is expensive, sugar is expensive. Food has become so expensive. Some things have become real luxury items. All of these price hikes are making life really difficult for us women. Every time you go to the market, the prices are higher. A kilogram of vegetables can cost 400 francs today and two or even three times as much tomorrow. Enough is enough.
The World Bank says the price hikes result from a number of factors: higher fuel costs, poor harvests, and increases in biofuel production have all contributed to the problem. And it's a problem that affects people in the developing world worse than in the industrialized world, where people spend a smaller percentage of their income on food. The N'Goula market in one of Dakar's neighbourhoods is bustling. And at every store you'll hear the same thing, customers and salespeople loudly haggling over prices. This is where the price increases the World Bank writes about take on a personal dimension. For the customers and for the people selling their goods, they feel like they have to justify prices they have little control over.
The government has to do something. One thing it could do is subsidize basic foods. Then I think the prices might go back down. But no one can expect us to buy goods at 200 francs and sell them for the same price. Food is expensive for us too. Things are difficult for us too.
It's not the people selling their wares that are profiting from the high prices. The main winners are financial speculators, according to rights activist Alioune Tine. Some food reserves are being kept from the market to drive supply down, while demand and prices increase.
There is really a lot of speculation, and states don't have an effective way of doing anything about these radical price hikes. It's a question of administrative structure and corruption. There are times when officials just close their eyes to what is right in front of them.
The people's widespread complaints and demonstrations haven't had much of an effect so far. But activists aren't taking no for an answer. They continue to call for protests in the centre of Dakar, and thousands of people keep showing up to vent their frustration over Senegal's prohibitively expensive food prices. The leaders of That's Enough campaign have been working since the beginning of the year with the rap group Pouji. They're trying to motivate even more people to push for their right to food. Rapper Oumar Touré, a.k.a. Tiat, is one of the group's original members.
We've seen that our country is in a really difficult phase. We think it's us young people who need to step up and get active. We can't stand around and watch anymore. We have to stop just accepting that prices for essential foods are getting 400 times more expensive than they used to be.
Activist Alioune Tine says he supports the rappers' call for action, but he says it's also clear that the government has to do something about the problem.
The priority has to be securing people's right to food. The prices have to be such that everyone has enough to eat.
Guy Deegan, Deutsche Welle Radio.
And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Do join us again at the same time next week. I'm Anke Rasper, and on behalf of the World in Progress team here at Deutsche Welle in Bonn, Eliane Giaducci and Jens Röhr, thanks for tuning in and goodbye.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.